It's the morning show. I'm John Munson. The new Democratic House of Representatives majority met yesterday to vote on leadership. As expected, the Democratic caucus chose Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House. The question now is whether or not she will have the 218 votes she needs to actually become Speaker in January. We discuss the results of the Democratic leadership vote with a political scientist and find out how the opposition to Nancy Pelosi might play out in January. Alisa von Hengel is an associate professor of political science and American government at my alma mater, UW-Superior. She specializes in women and politics. Alisa, welcome to the morning show. Okay. And I don't hear Alisa. We're connecting with our guest. I'm wondering what you thought about all the kerfuffle about Nancy Pelosi, and let us know what you thought of the vote yesterday by the Democrats to select her as their leader and put her forward as Speaker. She still needs to get 218 votes in January to actually become the Speaker of the House. But what did you think about the vote and about the other decisions that the Democrats made about their leadership yesterday? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Alisa, we have you now.
I hope so. Good morning.
Good morning. I don't know. The gremlins were out in force today.
yeah, they were just waking up, and I'm sure.
from a procedural standpoint, what happened in the Democratic caucus yesterday?
So the Democratic caucus met in a closed-door session, and although Nancy Pelosi was running unopposed for the speakership position, they did have a ballot, and so there were people were able to vote yes or no for Nancy Pelosi. And so the Democrats selected their person for the position, but as you mentioned, obviously earlier, it still has to go to the House floor for a roll call vote come January 3rd, and that's where there's talk that she might run into some trouble getting enough votes to continue to maintain that position.
Who was elected to the other leadership positions in the Democratic Party yesterday?
Most notably, we saw Hakeem Jeffries selected to the House Democratic Caucus Chair position. It's the number five position for the Democrats, and he was running against Barbara Lee, who was in Congress for about three decades or so. She's a little bit older of a woman. She's been in Washington in government for quite some time. But Hakeem Jeffries, a new up-and-coming member of the House from New York, was victorious. And he represents this, or is seen as representing this new generation of Democrats coming into Congress, new generation with perhaps a slightly different ideology or focus or goals. And with the vote to secure Hakeem Jeffries in this position, it really highlights the power and the influence of this sort of ideas of the new generation that they want a shift in leadership to hopefully create new strategies and for movement forward.
Was that a surprise that he was selected?
I think there was. It was perhaps not quite as much a surprise as Nancy Pelosi being selected, it was interesting in that, again, he was running against somebody with a tremendous amount of experience in Congress, in the White House, in Congress, in Washington. And, again, his position, he's been there since 2012. So he has a few years in Congress under his belt. But it is quite an upset for somebody who's been in Congress for such a little time to have beaten out Barbara Lee, who's a popular Democrat, who's been there for well over 30 years and has been successful in achieving a lot of goals that she's pushed through in Congress.
The race for Speaker of the House was the headline maker. That's been the lead story here. but in the end, Nancy Pelosi ran unopposed. But what were the issues of the people who were saying they didn't want her to return as Speaker?
Well, for a lot of the new incoming members, Democrats to this Congress, they actually flipped Republican districts, and they come from constituents that are more moderate, that were previously voting for Republican lawmakers. And so a lot of these individuals, and often based upon how she's been characterized in the media and in campaigns, saw her as representing the ultra-liberal, too liberal faction of the Democratic Party. There's also some that see that her focus or the issues that she's raising at the start of this next session represent old ideas, and they're not seeing a representation of the ideas or the goals, the issues that they feel are most essential to be addressed. So there's a kind of a mix of positions from this opposition, and it's unclear, really, it changes, it seems, from day to day, who's in and who's not part of this opposition. But there are those who see her as, I think in general, overall, the concern is that it represents, again, this old, outdated leadership that we've had in this position for a number of years, and that it's simply just time for a change.
But nobody stepped up to actually be the face of that change. There were some members who, you noted, actually ran on their, at least in part, it wasn't a major part of their campaign, but they did say they weren't going to support Pelosi as Speaker, who maybe changed their minds after they were elected and after they met with her. But who would they put up? I mean, you can't replace somebody with nobody.
Right, and that is the catchphrase that seems to be everywhere. And I think so. Marsha Fudge, a Democrat from Ohio, was sort of, it seemed, flirted with the idea for a little bit of potentially running against her. But as Marsha Fudge noted, and as did, you know, I think everyone involved, that she does have the votes. She is a very seasoned legislator, and she was working with, you know, individuals, you know, in her party to get them to, you know, to demonstrate that she has momentum, that there's really nobody who could stand a chance to oppose her. And so they just, as of right now, there is no candidate of, you know, choice for this opposition to Nancy Pelosi. Whether or not someone will emerge when it seems now that there may be a chance to upset the vote, the roll call vote in January. But there still has not been any names floated. One of the individuals involved in the opposition to Pelosi did run against her in 2016 within her own caucus, Tim Ryan, and he received 63 votes in opposition to Pelosi in 16. And as you mentioned earlier, she lost 32 votes yesterday. So whether or not he will be the face of or the leader of this in the future, I think there's still trying to figure out who exactly could be the person that would stand a chance at beating Pelosi.
Okay, so if you had to put a little money down on this quickly, will she get 218 in January?
Well, I stopped betting on politics after the last presidential election.
Okay, well, but, never mind. We'll let you off the hook then.
She does have a very strong chance, and it, I think, would be quite the upset if she was to lose. So,
all right,
I'll say that.
We'll leave it there. Lisa Van Hagel, an associate professor of political science and American government at UW Superior, specializing in women in politics. Thank you so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And go Yellow Jackets. Still ahead on the morning show, we explore silent letters and confusing spellings that pepper the English language, and we are going to have some fun with this. Plus, we want to know, what's your favorite children's book? Call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Next up, P for pterodactyl. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Alphabet books are usually for brand new readers. They're a time-honored way to learn the letters, sounds, and rules of a language. You know, A is for apple, that whole thing. Well, not so in Raj Haldar and Chris Carpenter's new book, P is for Pterodactyl, the worst alphabet book ever. It might actually be the most difficult alphabet book ever written, and also, I think, the most entertaining. P is for pterodactyl, shuns nice, rule-following words in favor of some of the most gnarly and confusing words in English.
A is for azle.
Azle.
Isle.
B is for...
Delio?
Galenium.
Delium?
C is for Caesar.
Kazar or... I don't know.
Czar. Kazar.
The book is all about the vestigial organs of language, silent letters. We have Raj and Chris with us, the authors of P is for Pterodactyl, the worst alphabet book ever. They're going to tell us more about it. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Raj, let's start with you. How did you get the idea to write an alphabet book exclusively featuring words that break the rules?
Well, it's all sort of started as a group of friends and I, Chris included, were talking about... you know, strange, tricky words in the English language. And Chris, maybe you can actually tell the origin story a little better.
Yeah, well, we were visiting with our mutual friend who had a young kid. His name's Isaac. And we were playing with these learn-to-read alphabet flashcards. And yeah, it was like A is for apple. And when we got to Q, the flashcard said Q is for quinoa. You know, which we thought was funny because, first of all, you know, what 3 or 4 year old, you know, knows about quinoa? You know, like I know about gummy worms, I know about birthday cake, I know about quinoa. Those are my three things. You know.
Q is for quinoa.
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 So we just kind of got a laugh out of that, and then we also said, well, wait a second, that's not even a very good. Like Q word, you know what I mean? Because you don't say it like a regular Q. It's more of a K sound. And so if you think like us, you know, the next thing you think of is, well, what if we wrote a whole alphabet book with bad words like that?
We'd spend a month or two with a Google document, and we'd pop into that document and add a couple words that started with a silent letter. And as that document started to populate, I think we both kind of, it was very clear to us that a world was evolving that was really kind of potentially exciting for a children's book. A world filled with czars and gnomes and tchotchke.
Yeah, you know, some of these words are pretty obscure, and they can be really, really tricky to say, even for grown-ups. I mean, I went to Google for help on a couple of these. But so this took you some time to do, a few years, right?
Yeah, correct. So we started from a place where, you know, Chris is a computer programmer. I'm a rapper producer. And so we didn't know anybody in book publishing. And so, you know, we really were starting from square one. So the whole process from, you know, ideation to finished book took almost 3 years. And, you know, the book kind of also changed shapes a couple times in that, you know, I think at first we were thinking, maybe this is just a sort of funny, gifty book for adults. But we started to realize that it could really have legs for kids. I think, you know, we went and did a couple readings in these last few weeks, and I've been, you know, astounded by how much 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds love big, goofy, unwieldy words. You know, we point to the cover of the book and we ask what this purple flying animal is, and, you know, kids that are just learning the language all know what it is and how to say pterodactyl.
We could spend all day complaining about the insanity of English spelling rules, but a handful of the world's words in P is for pterodactyl actually come from other languages. Why did you decide to include those words in particular?
Well, I think the idea was to make the book as educational as possible, you know, and also if we limited ourselves to just English words, we couldn't get it done.
That's absolutely true.
D is for Djibouti.
G is for gnocchi.
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 J is for Jaya Aliyah.
Aliyah. Aliyah.
Why can't I say it? Aliyah.
I don't know.
the reality is I think it's more important than ever that books like this are expansive and that, you know, kids understand that the English language is a living, breathing thing that, you know, is also a conversation between cultures. And and so it was important to have words like Haile and Djibouti. It's a good opportunity for kids.
One person described the English language to me as sort of the Borg of language. It just keeps assimilating other languages and owning them. We're talking with Raj Haldar and Chris Carpenter about their new book, P is for Pterodactyl, the worst alphabet book ever. It's not just the words that are tricky in P is for Pterodactyl. The sentences you feature them in sound like tongue twisters Lewis Carroll might have written. How did you come up with those?
So that was very much Chris's footprint on this project.
Initially it just became like a puzzle to fill out. You know, we would write a list of silent a list of words that started with a silent letter for a particular letter of the alphabet, and then it became, you know, can I put these words into a sentence that is, you know, silly and nonsensical, but a sentence nonetheless. So things went from a list of, you know, pterodactyl and Ptolemy to Ptolemy the psychic pterodactyl struggles with psoriasis, something like that.
Ptolemy the psychic pterodactyl struggles with psoriasis.
Yeah, so that was, for me, that was a lot of the motivation, you know, just to see if I could do that for every letter of the alphabet in such a way that, you know, got a chuckle.
Yeah, and that sort of rhythm, the alliterative rhythm that we kind of carry through, really started from day one. And as we started to really see this thing as a children's book, we started to kind of also add words. You'll notice as you look at the sentences, there are other words for each letter within that sentence that have, you know, a silent letter in it. So, for example, in B is for Delium, we also use the word doubt in the sentence. So there's kind of levels of depth that you can dig into with the book.
The charging tsunami washed away all of Chachkas.
The wren wrapped the rabbit's gift in red, but forgot to write a note.
And I noticed the czar is actually a Czech. This was just an extremely enjoyable read. Neither of you are authors by trade. Chris, you're a computer programmer. Raj, you're a musician. Your background is as a rapper. How did that influence you as you wrote this book?
I think there is something. As somebody from my entire adult life, I've been putting out rap albums. And there is a bit of similarity in this concept of, really, within a rap song, you have to really look at each couplet and make sure that it's saying, it's communicating exactly what you want to communicate, because it flies by so fast.
I never subscribed to Crosstown Beef. The Baroness of Broad Street, Bowling Green, black folding the sheets, holding the heat for months before they flow in the streets. 89 wise, intelligent, live and unique.
You know, with a book like this, we were working, you know, not done a word count, but I'm sure it's just a few hundred words, really. But, you know, it's astounding to me that we took 3 years and pored over just these few words for this project. And I see a similarity there.
Chris, writing this book, what was it like for you? You have a daughter. Has she taken a whack at reading P is for Pterodactyl?
She has, yeah. My daughter's a little young. She's three. I think that she learned what a pterodactyl was. She's on that level. I look forward to rereading it to her as she gets older. And she loves when we read to her. You know, in the evening, the number of books that we read to her becomes like a point of negotiation. You know, like, hey, Mila, that's my daughter's name. You know, it's really late, past your bedtime. Let's just read one book tonight, and then you have to go to bed. And she'll say, how about five books? Five. And we will usually just read her five books, you know. And just in reading to her, I just saw, you know, how much it really opened up the world for her. You know, not to sound like cliche about it, but it's really true. I mean, we'll be, you know, going about our day, and she'll say something which will indicate to me that, yeah, she learned that from that one book that she read, you know? And that became a huge point of, like, motivation for me to put something out there that can really, you know, open up children's minds.
Raj Haldar and Chris Carpenter, the authors of P is for Pterodactyl, the worst alphabet book ever, which came out this month. Thank you so much for joining us. Hope to talk to you again.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
P is for Pterodactyl.
This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm John Munson.
Wishing we never die, never be lost and gone. If we levitate or we reach the sky, all alive. All my life I always wonder why. The promises of the gods are just flaws of the human mind. Human lives are appreciated. Molecules is vibrating.
It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. I'm here all week, folks, and then on Monday, new host Kate Archer-Kent joins the morning show for good. She's a morning person who's passionate about bringing you conversations that will make you think, make you wonder, and make you smile. We just talked about a children's book that draws attention to some crazy spellings in the English language, and we're continuing the literary discussion now. Later today on The Larry Mueller Show, the director of the Cooperative Children's Book Center shares her new favorite picks for young readers. Now, we want to hear about your old favorites. Call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Here's what we want to know. What is your favorite children's book? Either a favorite that you read to your children, or a favorite that was read to you, or just a favorite children's book that you read as a child. Do you remember it from when you were little? Did you come across it as an adult? Why do you buy children's books? Do you read The Snowy Day to your children or grandchildren? Do you buy kids' books for other people? Share your stories. We want to hear about your favorite children's book this morning at 800-642-1234. Keely Boltina is executive producer of The Morning Show, and she joins us in studio to talk about kids' books. Good morning, Keely.
Good morning, John.
So my parents read to me until I learned how to read myself, and then I kind of took that over. But the first book I remember my mother reading to me was a Dr. Seuss, Yertle the Turtle. And I still remember, I'm Yertle the Turtle, oh marvelous me, for I am the ruler of all that I see. And I bought that book later on, and I read it to my children, and they enjoyed it also, along with a lot of other Dr. Seuss stuff. What book do you first remember being read to you?
Goodness, I went through so many when I was little. I do have one book that did not have very many words, and I actually got it when my grandma was moving out of her house, and it was a counting book, and I remember that the pages were thicker, and it would start with, you know, one animal, and then a second, and, you know, 10 ladybugs at the end of it, and they just kind of built on one another. Mm-hmm. And I remember listening to the words, but then running my fingers over that texture of the different, you know, cutouts that were in it, and something about that just always stuck with me. You mentioned the Dr. Seuss books. Those are great, but as a parent now, they're really long. Those are long books. They just are.
Well, but we heard the section of the program we just heard about P is for Pterodactyl. One of the authors said that his daughter negotiates at night for 5 books. So what if they were 5 Dr. Seuss books?
You can't do 5 Dr. Seuss books. You
really?
Definitely have to. You can work in some of the others. I can't pronounce the words in the Dr. Seuss books, John. So,
really?
Right.
Oh, see,
that's
I had fine. A lot of. Well, see, my father was in radio, and so I had an announcer reading to me sometimes. That was kind of.
I love it. I think it's interesting that when I mentioned the book that you asked me about, I went right back to my grandma. And another person on our staff also has a connection with children's literature and her grandmother. I want to go ahead and share with you Jana Rose Slice's story about her favorite children's books.
When I was little, I spent a lot of time at my grandma's house. She watched me through the day, and reading was a huge part of our day. She had this whole set of books that I loved. They were Raggedy Ann and Andy and all of their toy friends. And years later, I was thinking about these books, but I didn't even know what they were called. And all I could remember about the book was that in the beginning of each one, there was a map of the playroom and the backyard where all of the adventures took place. And my grandma has now passed. And I briefly mentioned it to my mom once, like, do you remember these books? Do you remember what happened to them? And she didn't. And of course, all of my grandma's stuff is gone and the house is sold by that time. And last year for Christmas, my mom didn't ask me what I wanted, which is very unusual because she always did, especially because she asked me what my boyfriend wanted for Christmas. So I was a little bit nervous what I was going to open. But on Christmas Eve, I opened my gifts and it was this whole set of these books that I had loved so much as a kid. So not only my mom and my sisters figured out what the books were, they also tracked down almost everyone in the set. So I now have them and take one out and read every once in a while and kind of giggle that they made me so happy back then.
I think that's the neat thing about books, is that certainly it's about the words, certainly it's about the story and the lessons and the illustrations, but it's also about the people that we're with when we read those books and how that really just resonates with us.
Well, and there's, you know, the idea of being read to, and Wisconsin Public Radio certainly has capitalized on that over the years with the long-running series Chapter a Day. We enjoy hearing someone else read to us, and especially if they can do character voices, so much the better. And children really seem to like that. I loved hearing Laura's story there. Share your story. What's your favorite children's book? What's the book you remember most from childhood? Either a book that you read yourself or a book that someone else read to you. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can share via email, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. And if you have a picture of that book, if you still have the book and you tweet that at us, that would be even more cool, or cooler, or whichever you prefer. 800-642-1234. We're talking about children's books. And by the way, the Larry Mueller Show will continue the conversation about children's books a little bit later on today at 11 o'clock. The director of the Cooperative Children's Book Center, K.T. Horning, will be here to share her new favorite picks for young readers. And get this, her list includes a mystery novel for three-year-olds called Baby Monkey Private Eye. And for middle grade readers, there's a Civil War adventure with dinosaurs called The Dactyl Squad. That's must listen to radio at 11 o'clock on the Larry Mueller Show today. But right now, we want to hear about your favorite children's book, either a book someone read to you when you were a child, or maybe some books that really meant a lot to you growing up. We've heard about Keely Bultina's favorite book when she was a little one, and we just heard a really cool story from Jana Roschleis. I understand that we also have a story from one of our other producers here at the morning show, Colleen Leahy, who shared with us as well. How about if we listen to that?
So when I was growing up, I loved the series of Unfortunate Event books by quote-unquote Lemony Snicket, also known as Daniel Handler. And I started reading them when I was in, like, late elementary school, early middle school, and there were 13 of them, and I was just completely obsessed, and every time a new one came out, I would get it, and I would read it, and stay up and read it, and not sleep. And the last one came out, there were 13, because it's a series of unfortunate events, and the last one came out in my freshman year of high school, and I still read it, and I wasn't even that embarrassed.
Oh, that's precious. 800-642-1234. That was Colleen Leahy, one of our producers here at the morning show. We have Mitchell with us from Oshkosh. Mitchell, good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you guys doing today?
Doing well, thank you. And what's your story?
My favorite book when I was younger is Go, Dog, Go. I absolutely loved seeing all the illustrations of that, like you guys mentioned earlier. It's just a really fun book for me to read. And with books of being younger, we had a huge bookshelf and like a whole shelf out of it dedicated to just children's books. And my sister and I, as we were growing older, we would also start to read them to each other or just read them on our own leisure. It just really resonated with me when I was younger.
Go Dogs Go. I remember that. Let's see. Do You Like My Hat? I think that was one of them. Mitchell, thanks for that. Let's go to Tracy in Fond du Lac. Tracy, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. So I really got hooked on the Sandra Boynton books. Your guest speaker alluded to the fact that, you know, the Dr. Seuss books are really long. And these Sandra Boynton books, like, for example, the Going to Bed book, it's just really fast, really straightforward. It helps with my, I read these books to my 8-month-old daughter, and they just have excellent messages that just rhyme, and they're just really well written, and I just like them all.
Tracy, thanks for sharing that with us. I really appreciate it. Angela is with us in Partyville. Angela, good morning.
Good morning. I agree with the last two callers that the Dr. Seuss, now some of them are really long, and some of them now have little cardboard books like the Go Dogs Go, and there's another one called the I Book that talks a lot about pronouns. It teaches the kids pronouns like my I see, his I see, his I see me, my I see him. But so I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, and something interesting I noticed was with my 5-year-old, friends gave me the Goodnight Moon book, and they were like, oh, my kids love this book. You're going to love it. And my son didn't care about it. But my 2-year-old absolutely loves it.
Okay. Angela, thanks for sharing that. Chris, let's go to you for a quick story. Chris, good morning. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just calling. I liked a lot of the Dr. Seuss books as a kid, read them to my kids when I got older. I really like Hop on Pop, Fox and Sock, stuff like that, with a lot of rhymes, tongue twisters. Trying to read them with the kids is fun.
Got it.
And then as I was like in my late childhood, maybe even into middle school, I really got into books by Wilson Walls, Where the Red Fern Grows, Summer of the Monkeys. Can't think of all of them, but.
Okay. Yeah. Chris, we got to go. Thank you so much for sharing your stories with us. And thank you to everybody who called. Keely, last word to you.
Goodnight Moon is great until you read it for 765 times, and then it loses its appeal. So you just set it on the shelf, and then you come back to it.
I read the entire Chronicles of Narnia to my children one chapter a night.
You're very impressive, John.
I am. Thank you. Thanks for noticing.
Anytime.
Hey, let's keep this children's book conversation going. Join us at 11 on The Larry Mueller Show for more about children's books. At 11 o'clock this morning on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, we discuss whether a fashion show featuring models in lingerie still resonates with people today. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The Victoria's Secret Fashion Show airs December 2nd, but enthusiasm for the media spectacle and the brand in general isn't what it used to be. We look at why the company is losing out to brands that promote comfort over sexiness and explore how its image squares with women in 2018. Did you once shop at Victoria's Secret but later decided to buy elsewhere? Was it a combination of cost and comfort or some other reason? Are you a mother with a young daughter who wants to shop at Victoria's Secret but feel conflicted about it? Or do you like the image of unabashed sexiness that the brand projects? Tell us why. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. ideas@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Tariro Mazewa is a staff editor and writer for the New York Times opinion section. She writes about culture, style, and human rights. Her recent piece is titled Victoria's Secret. In 2018, fewer women want to hear it. Tariro, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me.
Victoria's Secret is still the leading lingerie brand in the United States, but its share of the market is falling hard. Tell us about that.
Sure. So obviously we all know of Victoria's Secret. It's in almost every mall. we've seen the ads everywhere, and then there's the big fashion show that people look forward to watching every year. And what's really happened over the last couple of years is that they've lost their share of the market. I mean, they're still the leading brand, but more brands are popping up, like smaller brands, and those smaller brands are really connecting with women all over the place, and you see that across social media. So that's brands like Aerie, like Third Love, The NYX, True & Co. And what's common about a lot of those brands is that they're owned by women. So that's what I spent some time talking to people about.
Well, what did you hear? What are the reasons that Victoria's Secret is losing market share?
Well, one big thing is really the advertising. A lot of women say, you know, well, it's great that, you know, all these companies say they have diversity and they've got big sizes and they'll make products for me. I mean, it's not like Victoria's Secret only has tiny sizes, right? Like, they actually offer bra sizes from 38 to 40 double D, which is triple D, which is actually a good range of size. But if you put it in context, most women in the U.S. are a 34 double D and growing. And women have said, like, that's actually not enough options. But even more than that, it's not enough for a company to say, like, hey, we have a 40 triple D, but then not advertise with women who are 40 triple D, right? Victoria's Secret models do appear to have very similar bodies. They're very thin, and that's its image. It's consistently marketed with those women and put its, like, Victoria's Secret angels front and center, and women just are kind of sick of seeing that. They want to see their bodies reflected in advertising.
It's a famed fashion show, as you mentioned, airs this weekend. The viewership for that has also suffered. What do we know about the changes in viewership over the years?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, in 2013, the show was still a really big deal. And that's not all that long ago. I believe in 2013, 9.7 million viewers tuned in. That's a lot of people, but the show last year only had 5 million people. That's a significant drop in just a few years. So fewer people are connecting with it in that sense as well. And, you know, you might remember a time when it was a really big deal when it was announced who the angels were and which models were going to be part of the show. And you just kind of see less of that conversation. People aren't as invested in the brand in that way anymore.
Tell us about the history of Victoria's Secret and its brand. Who started it and why?
So it was started in the 70s, in the late 70s, by Roy and Gay Raymond. And it came to be because Roy had gone into a department store and he felt a little, you know, he felt self-conscious and like he didn't know what he was doing in there. He was looking for lingerie for his wife. And that's kind of really the genesis of Victoria's Secret. It was started by a man who knew what he wanted to find for his wife. And everything about the company has remained that way. It's really catered to the male gaze. It's like, what do men find sexy? What do men want to see women in? And we're kind of in a time right now where a lot of women are saying, like, I don't care what he wants to see me in. I mean, certainly a lot of women still feel that way. There's nothing wrong with saying, like, what does he want to see me in? But a lot of women are saying, well, what are my other options? And looking for companies that offer those other options.
You mentioned some of the startups that Victoria's Secret has been losing some of its market share to, like Third Love. The image that these brands project, how is it different from the one that Victoria's Secret is putting out there?
It's really different. I mean, Third Love, for example, has so many different campaigns. I know one campaign in New York City, they took over this passageway on the subway, and you'd just be walking down this hallway, and you see massive ads with, like, women of totally different sizes, different ages. Like, they have women with, like, gray hair who are, like, grandmothers. They have a woman with a baby, like a black woman with a baby. And they, you know, with that, they actually have a nursing bra, right? They're marketing to mothers. And that's a really big deal. Like, women want to see that. Or a company like The NYX, which also has, like, just regular women in their campaigns, they market, you know, their main product is leak-proof underwear. That's the one. That's the thing that really they're known for. They also do bras, like sweat-proof bras. But the leak-proof underwear is also something else where they, you know, the owner Joanna Griffiths said, "I was really thinking about how women's bodies change over time, and I wanted to reflect that."
Teriro Mazewa is a staff writer or staff editor and writer for the New York Times opinion section. Her recent piece is titled Victoria's Secret in 2018. Fewer women want to hear it. A retail analyst you talked to said that Victoria's Secret is losing share to other brands because it's out of touch. What did he mean by that?
Yes, that was a retail analyst at Citibank, and he really had some insightful comments about this. I mean, he follows the sector so much, and he mentioned that Victoria's Secret is out of touch because, largely because of how it's marketing to women. Like, women just want to see something different, and Victoria's Secret needs to catch up and make some changes if it wants to thrive in an era of, like, body positivity movements and all these different choices that women are making. It needs to just alter itself and catch up that way.
Is part of the problem the fact that, Victoria's Secret is almost exclusively run by men?
Oh, definitely. I mean, Victoria's Secret's board of 12 people has 3 women on it, and one of those women is the CEO's wife. I mean, that's definitely, you know, it's hard to overlook that. And when you look at these newer companies, they're run by women. So everything about the company, everything about Victoria's Secret from its creation has been about men and how they want to see women. But you see it now in 2018, and it's still the same, and the company is still run by men. I mean, you had one of the executives making a comment to Vogue a few weeks ago now, saying they considered casting, you know, they've considered casting models who look different, like plus-size models and transgender models, but they just didn't really make the cut. And that's, you know, I think that says a lot to women who want to see different people.
Is another part of their problem the fact that they're pretty heavily invested in stores located in shopping malls, which themselves are losing traffic? Do they just not get enough traffic in their stores?
They don't get enough traffic in their stores, and they've closed a number of stores, but they're still doing all right in that sense, and they are available online. But you also consider the fact that if fewer people are going into the mall, fewer people are going into the store, and then the ones who do go into the store sometimes just feel a sense of being, like, overwhelmed. Either they don't really want to talk about their bra sizes or feel like they have to buy something with the pressure of, like, a saleswoman or a salesman, or, you know, they just find the store itself overwhelming, right? It's a lot of pink, which, I mean, I love pink, but not everybody does, right? It's like an overpowering color. It's the scent of all the perfumes that they sell, but they also do makeup sometimes. And then you think, okay, do I want to go over to their more like college athleisure stuff, or should I just be looking at the more sexy, lacy stuff? I think people just find the process of actually being in store very overwhelming.
Teriro Mazewa, thanks so much for joining us this morning. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Teriro Mazewa is a staff editor and writer for the New York Times opinion section. She writes about culture, style, and human rights. Her recent piece is titled Victoria's Secret in 2018, Fewer Women Want to Hear It. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.